This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Charles Goyette back to the show. He is the author of the new book, The Last Gold Rush Ever. Seven Reasons for the Runaway Gold Market and How You Can Profit from It. He is I'd call you an economic historian. Is that a fair name, Charles? Welcome back.
Well, it suits me. I'm pleased to be called that. It doesn't hurt my feelings.
Good stuff. Well, we are living in really just amazing times right now. I mean, just amazing times. The world feels like it is falling apart. You know, I thought of something today. I was thinking instead of social distancing, maybe we should have socialist distancing.
That would be nice. And maybe we could do more than 6 feet.
Exactly. Like 6,000 feet would be, even 6,000 miles would be better. But yeah, so just give us your overall take of the world today. You know, the last time I saw you was maybe 3, maybe even 4 years ago. You spoke at one of our events in Phoenix for my mastermind group. We really thank you for coming out. Everybody really enjoyed hearing from you. And you've been on the show before, but not for a while. And a lot has certainly changed.
It certainly has changed. And, you know, I wrote a book in 2008 or 9 called The Dollar Meltdown. And I ran through a whole lot of monetary and economic precedents and stuff. And I said, now, the recommendations in this book are only good for this year, maybe next year and the year after.
Right.
But all of the things that I've described in here, all of these things are precedents and economic lessons that I'd like you to learn. And you can call upon them when you need them at some future date down the road. And that was actually, it turned out to be a very good call, Jason, because the calls that I made in 2008 were for gold to go up and silver to go up. And boy, did they ever for the next 3 years. So it was right on the money. But the important thing was that people were advised to take advantage of the book to learn the lessons of economic history in case they repeat. Well, here they are now. And all the things that I wandered through back then, it's time now to call on them and look at them, because this is... It sounds kind of crazy, but in many ways, this is an end game. And so the name of this book, The Last Gold Rush Ever, it's not about prospecting, it's not about mining, but it is about the last gold rush out of the U.S. dollar as it's presently configured. And, you know, we've had in the last less than 100 years, we've had three versions of the U.S. dollar. We had the gold dollar until the 1930s, in which anybody could take a $20 gold piece to the bank and get a $20 bill, or more likely, a $20 bill for a $20 gold piece. But it was the gold dollar. The dollar was, as they said, good as gold. And the paper money was only a warehouse receipt for the gold that was held at the treasury at the bank and could be called upon any time. After that, we had the gold exchange dollar. And it didn't do any good to be an American and want to exchange your dollars for gold, because it was illegal for you to own. But if you were a foreigner, if you were the Bank of England or a foreign institution, you could line up and exchange your dollars, which you had been promised by President Nixon would always be redeemable in gold. And that promise was broken. You know what it was like? It was like our country was like a check kiter. Our country was like somebody writing bad checks on an account that they knew they didn't have enough deposits
now,
to cover.
Now, a lot of people won't even understand that metaphor because they're too young. But check kiting is this idea that someone would write, back in the old days when checks used to take a while to clear, you could sort of live this fake life. Now people do it on credit rather than checks, right?
They run a charge on their MasterCard to pay their Visa, and then their Visa to pay their
That's essentially the idea.
Yeah,
so check kiting, you'd you'd write a check that didn't have any money behind it. And then before that check cashed, maybe you got a 7-day float, you'd write another check from another account to back up that check. And it was just, so what you're saying is that the government is doing this or the Federal Reserve is doing it, right?
Well, the U.S. government was quite clearly doing it. And we were even a little bit arrogant about it. John Conley was the Treasury Secretary back in that day. And he said to the rest of the world, the central bankers of the governments of the world, well, the dollar's our currency, but it's your problem. Party har har. Mm-hmm. And we could get away with that because, you know, we were the global hegemon at the time. And, you know, we had the dollar reserve currency of the world at the time and so on. But in any event, we were frankly busted for issuing more checks than we had money to cover. We had more paper claims for gold than we had gold. And so Nixon broke the last tie of the dollar to gold in 1971. And since then, we're on the third dollar standard, which is just the plain dollar standard. There's no pretense that it's backed by anything. There's no statutory regulation that controls how many are issued and so on. And so, you know, other countries have done worse. I mean, Brazil went through the 90s. I think they went through 5 or 6 currencies. But in the last 80 years or so, we are on basically the third currency. All of them in succession failed, and this one is breaking down now.
Okay, so Charles, look, at the thing I love about talking to you is that you're a historian, and history provides context. And so, you know, didn't people say this in 1975? Didn't they even say it back in 1933? You know, that was a big deal in 1933, of course, when, you know, they had the confiscation. You know, didn't they always say these kinds of things that, oh, this is the end game? I mean, look, you know, I look at just the past 20 years. I mean, Peter Schiff has been predicting the end of the world for 20 years, right? Howard Ruff was predicting it in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and it never happened, right? You know, the thing that just I think is hard to comprehend when we're in it is that can't they just keep kicking this can down the road indefinitely?
Jason, this is why I like speaking with you, because you gave me such a softball. I'm so grateful for it. Hey, but it's the important question.
Listen, I'll tell you something. You are not Joe Biden in a presidential debate, so I'm not giving you a softball.
Listen, it is true that, look, there have been gold bull markets in the past, and there was one in the United States that topped out. The gold price had been suppressed or controlled by the government for many years, so there was a gold bull market, and when they took off the lid, they took the lid off the pressure cooker, and gold went up. The gold went in a huge bull market in 1980, topped out in 1980. There was another gold bull market that topped out in 2011, made kind of a double top the next year. All of these are what we call secular gold markets, and all bull markets in gold are driven by two things. They're driven by like national debt, irresponsible domestic economic policies of indebtedness, and by central bank or currency issuing authority irresponsibility. So by, let's say, by money printing, derived by debt and money printing. And all of these episodes here and overseas have been driven by things like that. What's going on in Venezuela, the destruction of the currency there, of course, the same thing. Debt, money, spending money they don't have, money printing that's not backed by anything. All of these are secular bull markets, but there is something quite, quite different about this one, which is why we call it the last gold bull market ever. This is a unique, this is a crossroad of history, and gold always shows up in the crossroads of history. So we're at a crossroads of history, and by that I mean everything economic happens at once. So best example I can give, for example, is when an arson investigator comes to see what's the problem, why did the house or the building burn down, he looks for the natural fuel, he looks for the fiber board, or he looks for the wood framing and so on that allowed the structure to burn. But he also looks for the accelerants that were used to spread the fire in the arson's diabolical plan. So in this case, we have all of the infrastructure that all bull markets always have, but we have them in a monstrous quantity of debt and of money printing. Unprecedented. But
didn't they think
strange
the quantity was monstrous before,
of
though?
Of course. Of course. And it relatively speaking was. We can put some numbers on this later and show you that this is far beyond what
I completely agree that this is absolutely astronomical. We are dealing with numbers we never thought we'd see, right?
Absolutely.
But But they thought that when the numbers were so much lower, they seemed really high. I mean, you look at old speeches like, you know, with Reagan, for example, mm-hmm. right? And he's talking about the deficit and he's talking like such small numbers. He doesn't even talk in trillions.
Well, give you a better idea than that. We had the first $1 trillion national debt. I don't mean just the 1 year deficit of $1 trillion. But the first $1 trillion national debt was in Reagan's first term. And you can look at me and see that my hair is, I guess, kind of, you know, that I was around back then. And I remember carrying petitions that a lot of us were carrying then, no, you know, no $1 trillion national debt.
Right.
Well, it broke $1 trillion when Reagan was president. So we had gone through, you know, 200 plus years of American history. We'd fought two world wars. We'd opened the West. You know, we had fought in Vietnam and we bought Alaska and we bought the Louisiana Purchase and all of that.
You know what we did this time, Charles? We paid to fund the welfare state.
Yes.
Aren't you proud of us?
Yes. So what do we have to show for it now?
Yeah. We have exactly a bunch of dependent people that vote for Democrats. That's what we have.
So this year we ran in the fiscal year that just ended at the end of October, we ran not the national debt. The gross national debt hit $1 trillion when Reagan was president. Now, just the 1 year deficit that adds up with all the debts that have gone before, the 1 year deficit was over $3 trillion.
Right.
They just finished the month of October counting, the first month of the new fiscal year. I think it was just under $300 billion for the month. So these numbers are astronomical, but. Yep. What I think it's important for people to understand is that this is a malevolent convergence of a whole lot of things happening at once. So there are all these additional accelerants in addition to the debt and the wholesale money printing. We have, you would certainly know about this, and you've alluded to it a couple of times. We have a rampant kind of a runaway move towards socialism in this country.
Right.
And that undermines the productive capacity of the country.
Sure.
And that takes capital from productive uses. And this is what you alluded to. You know, we bought the Louisiana Purchase and we bought Alaska and so on with state spending back in that day. But today we spend it all on consumption, on the welfare state. So, yeah. But we have a newfound huge popularity of socialism that we have not had before in this country, coming at the exact wrong time when we can least afford it. So that's one of the accelerants we talk about in the last gold bull market ever. And there are a number of others. I'm watching the Secretary of the State, Mike Pompeo, run around the country, and he's trying to get cooperation on national government initiatives of restrictions, trade restrictions and embargoes and this, that, and the other. And he's meeting with an unforeseen, unexperienced by Americans in modern times resistance from all over the world. And that's one of the other accelerants that we're facing is a breakdown of America's global hegemony. America's global economic might has powered our diplomatic hegemony. And as our economic might subsides, our ability to control events in the world is subsiding as well. So for our economic might to subside,
mm-hmm. that means it's essentially has to be replaced with some other economic might, right?
Right. Or we can stay the same and others can grow.
Now, I assume you're going to say China is the one to take
good
the
lead, example.
Right?
Sure. Okay. Good example.
But, you know, I just don't think so because mm-hmm. I think China is 10, maybe 15 years away from a giant demographic problem. I think they are on the verge of major civil unrest.
As are we.
Well, fair enough, but their civil unrest has a completely different flavor than ours, right? I agree with you. You're absolutely right about that. You know, I think we're going to see a real secession movement in the country. I think it probably kind of needs to happen. I hate to say that, but I just don't see how these two sides of the political aisle can coexist. I really don't.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. But back to China, I actually agree with your point there. The leadership of the Communist Party has a very tricky problem. They have to keep those people employed that they have urbanized over the last couple of generations. And this is what keeps them up at night. You know, what happens if there is a trade shutdown? What happens if commerce with China stops? And it actually puts a whole new light, if you look at it, it puts a whole new light on the American geopolitical or global military empire. You know, the pretext for the current level of defense spending in this country since the Obama pivot is, well, we have to keep the sea lanes open in China. That's a number one military objective now. Right. But China, who wants to close the sea lanes? Mm-hmm. China can't afford it. Yeah. With their, you know, ever since Deng Xiaoping, it has been a necessity that they would grow, that they would need more goods coming and going from China. There's no other way. I mean, you could have kept Mao and kept the heel of the boot of the state on the face of a billion people all these years, or with the freeing of their economy, it's inevitable that trade and commerce would start flowing through the South China Sea. Sure. But 75% of the shipping there, Jason, comes and goes to China. So it is in their interest to keep the trade lanes open, and more so even than ours. And if the trade lanes were shut, that's when the civil unrest that you alluded to really becomes frightening for the leadership there.
Yeah, no question about it. So I'm not a China bull. I mean, you know, I was, but I just don't think China has anywhere near as good a future as some think it does. I just think that the freer society is going to win out. I mean, look at what happened. I think COVID rescued them from the Hong Kong problem. You know, I mean, it was like, don't wear a mask. Oh, now you got to wear a mask. You know, like, that was ironic, right? I mean, I don't mean to make light of that because it's a terrible situation, obviously. But I was in Hong Kong right before that unrest broke out. I mean, like the week before. You know, had I stayed a week longer, I would have been in the thick of that. So it's really crazy what's going on there. But I mean, what do we do with all this, Charles? I'm assuming you're saying the future is inflationary, right?
Well, I'm certainly saying that the future is a different role for the dollar, and it's no longer the dollar reserve. In fact, I'm glad we're speaking about China. That, you know, only a couple of years ago, China was the largest creditor of the United States Treasury, the largest foreign creditor, and it held about $1.3 trillion worth of U.S. debt. So at a time of growing indebtedness, we need all the creditors we can get. But this has changed now, and they are de-dollarizing, as is the rest of the world. This has enormous implications for the American people and the American economy. But China has gone from the number one creditor of the United States of foreign nations to number two now, and they are down from $1.3 trillion. They're down to $1 trillion. And the trend is, as they say, your friend, the trend is very, very self-evident. Russia has done the same thing. Russia at probably under $200 billion as the United States creditor. You know, in these days, we need every $200 billion creditor we can get. But Russia had about $200 billion of United States Treasury instruments that it held. Now, if you look at the Treasury reports, Jason, they put Russia down in the asterisks, down with, you know, like Syria and Iraq and Vietnam. Wow. You know, I mean, they basically have nothing. And what have they done with that money? Mm-hmm. They've moved it. They've moved their central bank reserves to gold, yeah, as has China.
So it would be fair to call you a gold bug, wouldn't it?
I suppose. Okay. I suppose. Yeah, okay. That doesn't hurt my feelings.
Well, what about, and neither does an economic historian.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So, and what about cryptocurrency in all of this? What about Bitcoin?
So I think it's a wonderful thing that people are experimenting with Bitcoin and developing alternative currencies. You know, the great economist Hayek said, you know, let all kinds of currencies evolve, get rid of the legal tender laws, and let people settle on the ones that they like. So I think it's a good thing. And I'd like to know exactly how things will pan out over the long term with Bitcoin and some of the other cryptos. And I think we should find out experimenting with your money rather than mine. So, but I mean, I'd like to know, and I, you know, I wish them well. You know that the Fed has on the drawing board their own kind of Bitcoin wallet, Federal Reserve.
That's the one that's going to
blockchain. You know, oh, sure. Yeah.
It'll win by force.
Of course, which is how you know it's kind of the end game. Nobody has to use force or pass legal tender laws when the currency is of self-evident value. You know, it's just like a run on the bank. No, nobody's ever staged a run on the bank to exchange their gold for dollars. Give me my dollars. You've got to give me my dollars. It's always been the other way around. And it's the same thing with legal tender laws. You know, if they have to use the force of law to keep you using their currency in the face of alternatives, then there's probably reason to be suspect of the currency.
Absolutely. You know, there's a great meme, Charles, that I remember I posted on Facebook a few years ago, and it was a picture of riot police with their gear and their shields and their batons and all that stuff. And at the top, it said, "Socialism. Ideas so good, we have to force you to accept them."
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And as Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with socialism is pretty soon you run out of other people's money.
Yeah, absolutely. You sure do. So your advice would be buy gold, right?
Yeah, my advice is absolutely. My advice is that the present currency system cannot last. And so people that see it in breakdown and they see the convergence of these currency wars in which countries race to the bottom to destroy the purchasing power of the currency, they see the war on cash, which should be a whole conversation by itself. They see all these things going on. These are symptoms of a growing failure of the currency. And so rather than waiting for the stampede when people line up around the block, I suggest that people take steps to protect themselves now. Right. And it's, yeah, it's not, you know, I'm not here to tell you how high gold will go next year or next month, but I am here to tell you quite clearly that the signs are quite evident that the current monetary system is in a state of breakdown.
Yeah. So is gold a currency and an insurance policy, or is it an investment? There is a difference, right?
Yeah, it depends on the times. And it depends on how you buy it. You know, people that buy gold shares, which have a use and a place in some portfolios, people that buy ETFs have a use and a place in some portfolios, are trading it as an investment. But it is not a currency. Here is the sole virtue. Here is the reason that in a time of economic transition, in the time of a breakdown, Jason, here is the sole reason that gold stands separate and apart from everything else. It is the only monetary asset in the world that is not somebody else's liability. Right. It doesn't matter who signed the certificate. It doesn't matter, you know, if they are audited by honest auditors or dishonest. None of those things matter. Whose face, whose picture is on it? None of those things matter. It doesn't depend on anybody's performance. It doesn't depend on how well the mining company is administered or whether somebody's embezzling funds. It doesn't depend on whether somebody has rehypothecated or hypothecated the gold in the ETF to someplace else and the title's not clear. All of those things are irrelevant because in a period of crisis, you're holding an asset with gold and silver that is a monetary asset that is not dependent on the promises of counterparties or risks and failures by other parties.
Okay, so it does depend, though, on the two economic drivers, as I see them, scarcity and utility.
Right.
And so you've got to have people, I mean, since it's not really an industrial metal very much like silver or other metals, certainly are even more so, you know, it's a monetary metal, right? So people have to keep believing that it's the thing, and they certainly have for 5,000 years, so it's got a good mm-hmm. history behind mm-hmm. it. But also, it has to depend on scarcity. And, you know, this is not as far-fetched as some might think, but, I mean, you know, we're pretty close, Charles, to mining asteroids and discovering all sorts of abundance. And if you even look at oil as an example right here on Earth, you know, in the doomsday-ish 70s, and, you know, the conservation mentality of Jimmy Carter and, you know, wear a sweater, don't make the house warm because we
don't
have
enough oil. Moral equivalent of war. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that whole conversation about peak oil, right? You know, for sure, we thought the world was going to run out of it. And then we discovered a new way to access it, and that was fracking. And now it's totally abundant, and it may be being produced abiotically. Nobody knows for sure about that, but certainly there's a lot more of it than we ever thought. Could that happen with gold? I mean, maybe gold isn't as scarce as we think, right?
Well, it's very scarce. And despite the fact that most of the gold, perhaps 95, 97% of the gold that's been mined in history is still in human hands. Think about that. Thousands of years of gold production, and it's still in human hands, and yet the value of it keeps going up year after year. But you're right. You know, asteroids may come. People may discover new ways of reclaiming gold from the oceans and stuff. But these are very expensive processes that take a long time to develop. But the potential demand for gold in the face of some sort of a remonetization is just, it's simply off the charts. I mean, we have enough gold now for everybody to have an ounce. That's not very much.
But to your point a moment ago, you said the value of it keeps going up. And I think those are sort of critical words right uh-huh. there. I think those are very important words. So I don't want to compare it to dollars, because most economists would. They'd say real dollars or constant dollars, you know, an inflation-adjusted dollars. Has the price of gold gone up? Yes, it has, because the dollar is depreciating. Maybe it's not that gold is appreciating. And the funny example is, you know, 5,000 years ago, you could buy a toga and a pair of sandals with an ounce of gold. Now you can buy a man's suit and a pair of shoes. Uh-huh. You know? So I don't know. Is gold actually going up in value, or is it just holding its own as a measuring stick?
Yeah, it holds its own, and the currencies that it's measured against rise and fall as well based on their domestic economic fundamentals. But note this, that the price of gold has hit new all-time highs this year in not just in the U.S. dollar, but in all the currencies of the world. And I don't say just the major currencies, but all the currencies of the world, it's hit new all-time highs. So there is a burgeoning demand for it. I saw today that the Russian Sovereign Wealth Fund has got legislation pending so that they can now start owning gold. You know, this is the fund that they sell their oil and they provide for their sure. national pensions with and so on. The movement of central banks into gold with money they used to hold, with reserves they used to hold in dollars. There is a strange new respect for gold going on all over the world. Old hidebound institutions that never even looked at it. You know, Warren Buffett has made himself kind of notorious for his disdain for gold over the years. But now, you know, this year he has sold bank shares to move money into gold shares. So, you know, and of course, this is to be expected because the handwriting is on the wall. It's not just we that see that something is wrong, but, you know, the Treasury has a lot of debt that they've got to fund. They've got a lot of money. The demands for resources that the Biden administration will make on the American people are enormous compared to the already enormous demands today.
Hopefully, the money has to come from somewhere. Those demands, but you know, the likelihood is yes. Even both sides of the aisle are spenders. I mean, let's just
of course
call it what it is. They're both everybody's a Keynesian nowadays. Except Ron Paul. So I'd like to close with two areas of interest for you. One is the New World Order, and the other is this more recent talk, maybe from the New World Order, I think that'd be fair to say, about the and I'm going to quote, this is not a conspiracy theory. They say it, okay? You know, it's just listen to their words, not ours, the Great Reset. So what about the New World Order and the Great Reset? Let's wrap it up with some thoughts on that, those things.
Yeah. Well, the New World Order is certainly coming. It's not in a defined form. There are many people that have defined ideas that they would like it. But in the meantime, the old world order is breaking down. And it's breaking down really fast. And there are a lot of people that, you know, would like to rush from Davos to the legislative halls of the world and get implemented their version of the New World Order. The real New World Order that will manifest after I don't know how much heartbreak, and I don't know whether it is born in with the old one ending with a whimper or with a bang, but the New World Order is certainly going to be highly decentralized. That is the mega trend of the times. The state always fights decentralization, always wants to consolidate power and resources. But the real mega trend, and you can see this going on in our subtle social lives and social circles, is decentralization. So we're in for a conflict, you know, in which the organic order of things, which is, you know, people don't want their schools run by institutions thousands of miles away. We need to have a decentralization of the monetary system, the healthcare system, the education system, and many, many other things. And these things will manifest. It's just, you know, the old world order is coming apart at the seams. So it's a question only of what will the state do? How far is it willing to exert its authority to insist on its version of a new reset? It's always been, in fact, this is the difference between socialism and communism. The question, socialism, it has friendly face. It doesn't, you know, it's not a boot heel like communism is. Well, the question is, if you have a central plan, you have a central economic plan, what's the good of having a central economic plan if you don't intend to enforce it? And of course, the central economic plan runs into conflict with people's individual plans. So if you're a serious statist, you have to enforce it. And ultimately, it comes down to the point of, you know, enforcing it with force of arms. So these are the choices that are ahead of us. And I actually fear that they will end very, very poorly. When the state begins to lose its power, when its power base begins to decay, it thinks that the problem is a lack of military resources. And this is as old as the fall of Rome. I mean, Gibbons talks about this. You know, the overstretch of the empire is a question of the empire saying, well, we're too weak. Nobody's following us. Nobody's doing what we say. We need more military resources. And they get those resources at the expense of the domestic economy.
Of course.
The resilience of which was the source of their might to begin with. So they drain the domestic economy at the expense of the empire. And that's basically where we're headed. And the currency and the empire are coextensive one with another. The dollar and the American global military or empire are coextensive, and they rose together and they will fall together.
And what all of this really relates to is what we've been talking about on the show, which is the Cantillon effect and the massive hollowing out of the middle class. It's been happening for a long time. It's only going to be an accelerant, as you put it. All of this will just be an accelerant. You know, the welfare state will increase in size because you got to keep the poor from rising up, right? That's what the government's going to do. They're going to placate. And then the elites who are closest to the money, as Richard Cantillon postulated, will get the most of the benefit.
They get it first. They get the first use of it before it's depreciated.
Absolutely. You know, everybody else is downstream from them. So that's certainly true. Charles, give out your website.
So it's charlesgoyette.com, Charles and then Goyette, GOYETTE.com. And you can see the book there, a couple of videos about the book and a couple of other things of interest. I believe that David Stockman, the budget director under the Reagan administration, I believe his preface to this book is posted there. And it's very interesting. He says that people that read this book, people that fail to read this book will be surprised at just how hot and how high this conflagration, this bonfire of calamities is going to burn with in the currency situation, the currency world.
Fascinating stuff. Charles Goyette, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always great to see you, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, HartmanMedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.